Why, hello and welcome. Welcome to the Peer Pressure Podcast. I am Diane, sometimes known as Diane Kamikaze, and I am your host. The reason why I do this podcast is because I like to say I am a champion of heavy music. I've always found my favorite songs since I was a young kid had riffs, hooks, were either metal, hardcore, hard rock, or punk, or something fairly aggressive in attitude and sound. And I am all about appreciating the people that keep that world going, whether they're musicians, webmasters, other podcasters, record label and festival owners. It's important to me to recognize what these people do in that realm of music. So, I am here to bring them to you in a different context, more than a Wikipedia entry or a press release, a little more personal and a lot more fun. I'm a rocker for life, and I hope these episodes do make a difference. Send me feedback at diane@wfmu.org, and my Facebook page is Diane Kamikaze Farris, Rocker for Life. Like my page there, and I will keep everybody updated on podcast episodes in that space. Thanks so much for listening, and stay tuned. My guest today is John Zazula, Johnny Z, best known for being the head of Megaforce Records and the man who discovered Metallica. This was recorded in 2014, and as we speak now in 2019, he has a book out called Heavy Tales. If you are in the New York area, Thursday, October 24th, he is doing an event at the Cutting Room, which is like a book, I believe it's a talk and a signing. Make sure you look for him because I believe the book is new, so he'll be doing a book tour. This is part one. Because there's so much information he talks about in this one, Metallica, Anvil, SOD, Headbangers Ball, etc., etc. And there's enough material for a second podcast. So that's what you'll hear in a couple weeks on to talk to Johnny. I'm even more excited about what is in store for us in just a moment. Johnny Z, are you there?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Hey!
So what a great list of songs.
Yes, thank you for putting them out.
I love that Skatenigs album.
Me too.
You know who produced it? Question from me.
I don't know, but I would guess maybe like Al Jorgensen or Jello
Biafra. Boom, you got it.
All right. Well, I knew the connection, you know,
because yeah,
Phil Owen was also in Revco.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That was a great record. I'll when we're off mic, I'll tell you I have like the greatest Skatenig story in the world. But
I could tell you a few myself.
Well, that's why you're here. So my guest is John Zazula, best known as Johnny Z, the man who made the biggest difference in heavy music on the planet. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you for saying that.
I speak the truth. So what is going on with you now?
Well, what's going on now is that there's a partnership called Breaking Bands. It's a company that is put together with three people acting as equal managers. Partners are Chuck Billy from
yes.
Testament,
mm-hmm.
who, by the way, is a brilliant, brilliant guy, genius. And Metal Maria Ferrero.
Of course.
Who is a metal legend. She's one of the best, if not the best, publicists in the business today.
Mm-hmm.
And then me, who has a little bit of history, and we all know what it is. I'm not going to go talk about myself in public. But the three of us have started this company. And the first band we took on, or took us on, was Exodus. The new Exodus album comes out October 14th on Nuclear Blast. And we'll come out within a week, the same week throughout the entire world. Every little rock underneath it is an Exodus album playing. And we've noticed many great things happening with the band. I mean, the first wonderful thing is Zetro is back.
Yes.
You know, Dukes was a swell guy, but Zetro back takes the band back to where it was on Temple of the Damned.
I think that's a very important thing. Was that something that Breaking Bands worked on, or was the band in the middle of having that happen to begin with?
I really feel for Rob, it's better not to talk about it.
Okay.
You know, all I could say is that it had to come when it came.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy that Zetro was so into it, you know, because he has his other band, Hatriot. He put that on a burner, even though that's still alive, plenty. And he's joined forces. And already it's causing a sensation everywhere because the band has taken on a real vengeance. It's like they want to make their stake in the claim of, hey, we were there first in the thrash circles, you know. Also, the fact that Kirk came on and did that slam, and, you know, it's one thing if Kirk Hammond comes on and does a solo, but he does a slamming solo on the song,
Salt the Wound. Yes.
Those who have gotten to hear a little taste of what's coming will understand that this is an album, it's madness personified. The band is riffing like crazy. The whole group is insane, and Zetro sings like he is the Wicked Witch from the North. You know, he's just madman. And you could feel the insanity, and you could feel the sweat of the record. It's really cool. I'm so happy they made this record when we took over. And so that's Exodus.
For yourself, I mean, when you talk about being excited about a record, can I ask you about, like, when you first... Well, first, I believe you started with your record store.
That's correct.
And then you would take and you had, what was your connection? How did you get in touch with Metallica? And what made you decide, from all the accounts that I've heard, you just decided, you took this leap. Like, yeah, these guys are amazing, and I'm going to start a label to put out their record.
Oh, yeah, just like that. No, Marsha and I... under the Rock and Roll Heaven Presents, brought in Anvil to do shows, and it was a huge success. I mean, nobody knew who Anvil were, basically, except for us metalheads back then. And we did almost 1,000 people, you know, the first show we ever had. And people said, what was that? And then we brought Anvil back to do a bunch of shows and do a tour, and they played with Raven at the Headbanger Ball. And the success of the shows brought us to the place where we needed bands to come in. And the next bands that we thought we'd bring in would be bands like Accept, Venom, Vandenberg. We were trying to bring in Bodine from Holland, but we couldn't do it. And we did a bunch of shows, heavy metal shows. And at the time we heard the first notes from Metallica on a cassette tape live at the MAB, the first notes blew us away, and we needed something sensational to do, fresh and exciting. In front of all, we had 12 shows lined up, and we had good headline bills, but we didn't have support. And there were all these opportunities coming up as well, like Twisted Sister at the Fountain Casino.
I was at that show. That's the first time I ever saw Metallica.
He came up to me, Snyder, and said, these guys are really cool. I like what they do.
Oh, good.
You know, so he got it right away. Dee's been a fan of what we do from the very, very beginning of time. And so we heard this cassette in the store. The story's been told a million times, by the way. It's really weird for me to tell it again. we heard the cassette in the store, and I wanted to know, how do I get in touch with these people? Just like that, like an enlightenment. It was a fanzine. I believe it was Brian Slagle's fanzine.
Ah.
Or there was a story by K.J. Doughton on the band, a small story. And I had found out the number of K.J. Doughton. I think I got it from Ron Quintana, who was a KSUF DJ that I never spoke to in my life, got Quintana's number, and then from Ron Quintana, who became the head of the Metallica fan club later on and other things, he got Lars to get in touch with me. And Lars called, and I spoke to him. We never knew each other, but that was the beginning. On that phone call, they headed to the Northeast to play the 12 shows we had opened for them. And we developed a relationship and decided to put out the record by ourselves, and all this other crap all happened after that.
And so you got them right away. So in terms of they've just gone beyond what I can't imagine that you could have even dreamed that they're where they are now.
I have to be honest with you. Marsha and I thought from day one that this was the next Led Zeppelin. We didn't know how to describe it in those days. And the best you could say is Led Zeppelin, and that's exactly how we thought it would be. We never thought less. I don't know why. As I'm saying, this whole thing was a magic carpet ride, you know?
Yeah.
That's about it. You know, we started doing a lot of shows with Metallica in the area. Then we had someone put together a small Northeast tour. And then the record came out, and the record surprised everybody. You know, the biggest success was selling the first 5,000 of Kill 'Em All, you know? So, what other kind of things you want to ask of me?
Well, that just must have been, I mean, what an amazing experience to be able to have.
It was very, very, very interesting. And it was really, it was like getting hit with lightning and riding the bolt.
Yeah.
You know, when they said Ride the Lightning was the second album, I laughed. that's what it felt like.
Because you had been doing that.
I've been doing that, mm-hmm. Yeah. Surfing the lightning.
And how long did you have the flea market record store? And then how long did you have Rock and Roll Heaven? And then we had a question about the one in, I guess, Warwick, New York, that I'm not even aware about.
Okay. I don't remember these things, believe it or not. I know that we opened December 7th. I think 1982 or 81. Uh-huh. I don't remember.
Okay.
We lasted quite a while. We started off as the corner of a record stand. There was a whole big area that were used for selling 8-tracks and cutout records. And when you came by to see us, all you heard was Bobby Bear and all the rest of those guys. And you got no way to fold. You know, that's what you basically heard
right
in the early days of coming into Rock and Roll Heaven.
Hmm.
And we sold picture discs and things like that and oddities, and we started bringing in the metal. The first thing I brought in was the picture disc. Marsha and I brought in Judas Priest, had Wings of Destiny, which is one of the most beautiful import British albums of Judas Priest I've ever seen. From there, we went to Motorhead Beer Drinkers and Live at Hammersmith Odeon Motorhead and Angel Witch, mm-hmm. and Michael Schenker. And before you knew it, we had not only an entire store of heavy metal, but we had taken over the entire area within 6 months, and Bobby Bear and all those guys were gone. And Ozzy and Halford and Maiden and you name Sabbath and Angel Witch and Raven, you name it, they had taken over the space. And with a little Victrola, we would blast. No longer would you hear Bobby Bear, but you would hear Angel Witch and things like that.
Nice.
The rods cranked it up, you know, and Iron Maiden, Paul Di'Anno, Iron Maiden. We introduced Run to the Hills as a picture disc when it came out to introduce the new singer to be then of Iron Maiden, Bruce Dickinson. So it became a real mecca. And then the store, the flea market changed around and we weren't happy with the new management. So we made plans to move to Clark, New Jersey, where Brian Nyers, great member of the Old Bridge Metal Militia and dearest friend. He went and managed the store for several years in Clark, New Jersey, and that's where we had Metallica in stores, Anthrax in stores, Exciter in stores, mm-hmm. Manowar in stores. We were so popular. People came from 500 miles to see it. Then we started doing shows up in Rockland County. And my cousin was at every show, my cousins. And I basically spoke to them, and they spoke to me about starting a Warwick Rock and Roll Heaven North. That would be something where we could use them to promote our shows at the Chance and in Spring Valley and Suffern, etc. So we started the store, and that did very well. Eventually, there were a lot of bootlegs being sold in my stores from behind the counter from people who would work there in the part-time, and it really turned me off because I'm a firm believer in pay for it. I told them, do not sell bootlegs in my store. And I came up one day, surprise visit, man. The whole top of the counter was bootleg this and bootleg that, and I closed the store down right there.
Wow, really?
That's how it ended. And then we had no way to keep Rockland going because there was no more south. So we moved a lot of our inventory up there, but it was slowing down up there, too. We closed the whole thing down at the peak of business. I mean, it was really doing well. I mean, there are pictures of people lined up around the block. It was a big block to get into the store. You know, it was quite amazing. And from there we did, you know, we went into the record business. So Marsh and I, instead of making the records, or instead of buying the records, we're now making the records. And instead of selling the records in the store, we were selling the records to all the stores.
Right.
So that was the purpose of Megaforce, to take Metallica, make believe the world was rock and roll heaven, and just get as many record stores as we can. And what was beautiful is that they were bought and they were reordered. And the reorders came and came and came. You know, the first one maybe only sold 37,000 records at the time, but for a band no one ever heard of, for a label no one ever heard of, that was a lot.
Yes.
And then we came with Raven. And that sold like 25,000 right out of the box. And then we came with Manowar, and that was a big hit. And we just kept coming, hitting them with it. Boom, 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 boom. And every record was really great. And even in the Atlantic days, when Atlantic Records and Megaforce teamed up, they were surprised. How did Testament sell 47,000 records? I never heard of that band. You know, it was great.
You primed the world for all that. They just, Atlantic,
right.
Might not have
well, we
even
were the first ones who really developed a label out of nothing. You know, we didn't, everybody thought we were getting rich, but we were putting all the money back into employees and inventory and real estate and things like that. We had over $100,000 bar tab every month. I'm talking about bar tab, you know, tab to run the business. You could imagine what it was like to have the pressure of doing those kind of deals to maintain that money.
Hmm. I guess Anvil was one of the first bands. Did you ever put out an Anvil record?
Never, ever put out an Anvil record. My dearest friends in the business, next to Raven, and I never put out an Anvil record. Go figure.
Was the timing just off, or they were fine with what they had going on?
Well, they were a bit of royalty in Canada on Attic Records. Attic Records seemed to have a nice little buzz all of a sudden in Canada. And then they had another manager. We never managed the band, but they got a manager who really thought beyond Megaforce. You know, he thought that a major was the only way to go. And the band later tried to do business with us when that failed, and we were too off schedule. We just couldn't connect. That's really the story. We remain the closest friends. We go to Toronto. I mean, I've had barbecue at Lips's house and hung out with Rob all the time. And the reality of life is we were always friends, and we could always count on each other for shows and stuff. I'm not at a point now where I'm really putting out records, you know? And they're putting out some of their best stuff now since way back.
Yeah, they've got some longevity going on there.
You think so, huh?
Yeah.
That movie didn't hurt, you know? That Mambo movie didn't hurt them at all. So they're out there touring the world. I think every day they're playing another city or something. It looks crazy. In fact, the Old Bridge Militia band, Lords of Mercy, is doing a bunch of dates with them, which is really great.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that's nice to see. And it was really nice to see that our buddies Raven are out there with Except.
Yes.
And we all know that New Jersey's own Mark Tanullo is the lead singer for Accept. Of course, everybody knows that.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful?
That is wonderful. He's great at it, too. You know, it's funny. I've been so busy with the projects we're working on now that I haven't really been able to get involved with, or I'm not talking to anybody.
Oh, wow. Well, then
it's not like I'm not talking to anybody because I'm mad.
Right. It's just not happening.
Just time has passed.
Right. Hey, are there any bands that you passed on back in the day that you'd kick yourself for?
Well, I don't kick myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you're very successful in your own right, but...
Well, no. We were asked the first to be the managers of White Zombie, and we passed on that because we had ministry at the time. It just didn't make sense for us. And they went on, of course, to become very successful with Walter O'Brien. But they went there, and Pantera, you know, well, we were asked to manage them way back. But when Pantera came to us, they were like, you know, cowboy metal-like, you know? They were a different band than what they were when they came out of the box later on. So those are two. Can I think of any others? No. We got to do a lot of great things. When we retired from the business, Marsha and I took on a band in the jam band genre that was, right now is really into like those 3-4 hour raves and massive concerts and massive festivals. The name of the band is the Disco Biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
And Marsha and I were the original managers of the Disco Biscuits. We basically stopped managing them because I really felt like I had to retire for a reason. The reason was to not have to deal with any of the stuff that I had to deal with anymore.
Right.
You know, it was just a lot of stress and a lot of work, and I wasn't ready to really commit to that. And so the band went their way, I went my way, and now they're a huge success. You know, that's the Disco Biscuits
and
story.
The
And today that we're back in the business, and if anybody asks why did we ever go back in the business at Marsha and I, 62 years old, I just couldn't stand watching anymore. I saw all these metal bands coming back and really making their claim, and I felt that, you know, I'd like to be part of this. And then Maria Ferrero asked me, Johnny, would you like to manage Exodus with me? And I said, that's the perfect band for this.
She said, there's an idea.
There's an idea. So I said, I'm in. And then when she discovered that band down in Corpus Christi, Shattered Sun, sent me a tape. A lot of tapes we get, by the way. You can't imagine how much music we listen to. When I heard Shattered Sun, like, right then I knew this band is for us. And then we sent it to Chuck. Chuck flipped out. So we all went down to Corpus Christi. Got to see Shattered Sun. They got managed by Breaking Bands, and we're discussing with a few people where to put the album out right now. Great album they made. So that's the Shattered Sun story. We also manage a band. Well, the name of the fella is Forrest Day II. Forrest, F-O-R-R-E-S-T, Day, D-A-Y. Also, more in the jam band realm than heavy metal. The guy's great. He is changing what he's doing, his genre. So we figured we'd grab him and give him a shot. So we're working with Forrest Day. And I'm personally working with a fellow called Nim Bin. The best way to describe it, but the wrong way to describe it, is he fits into this whole horror punk movement that's going on right now, and basically gets lumped in with the Misfits and Doyle.
Oh,
and
God.
That kind of stuff. But he's really beyond that. He's horror, and he's dark, but he's one hell of a rock and roller, man.
Nice.
You know, Teddy was hard rock, is how I would describe Nim Bin. There was another great band we're looking to sign, like, very soon. Mum's the Word, until the deal's done.
Okay. Very good.
So that's where we're at right now.
I do have one question from the listener, and I think it sort of dovetails nicely with what we've been talking about. Because you were talking about you and Marcia sort of stressing out and managing the band. What is it like having a successful family business, and really is there any time that you're not working then?
Well, I have to tell you that I work as hard as I can, when I can, as much as I can. And Marcia's right there, because these days, I can't half the time remember who I'm dialing on the phone or who I'm going to call. You know, my memory is really bad. So Marcia's always riding shotgun, saying, John, you got to call Diane Farris. You know, or whoever it is. You know, I only have it X amount of hours a day, but I'm usually a vampire. I sit up all night working, which upsets people during the day, but at night I really focus in the dark, you know?
Yeah.
That's the way I am. That's why I love Nim Bin so much, because he's a real vampire kind of guy.
Oh, so you relate on that level.
We relate on that level.
Yeah.
You know, we understand what it's like to say, call me at 7 in the morning, John. He's in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only 4 o'clock. He's still up.
Right.
You know, and I go to bed at 3 and 4 and wake up at 5 and 6. So it's a crazy life I live.
When you said they pay me no money, didn't you coin the phrase headbanger's ball?
I own it.
Oh, you do own
it? But I never sued MTV.
So they just started using it? Did you have a there had to have been a conversation there, like, you know.
No, there was no conversation. It was really nasty, and I used it in my own way. What happened was the fellow who was the head of PR for a certain company who also did the PR for Anvil, who played the Headbangers Ball, was so impressed with the name Headbangers Ball that when he got a job at MTV, he named the show Headbangers Ball without even calling me.
Oh.
But I will say, instead of money, the theme song of the show didn't pay us, was Chromatic Death. S.O.D. Every time you turned on Headbangers Ball, you heard, between every track, you heard S.O.D., which was one of the Megaforce bands.
Right.
And they are probably one of the legendary of all time Megaforce bands. And then when it was time to do the Headbanger Ball concert tour, and the tour was basically Anthrax, Exodus, and Halloween. So they got behind us on the tour that actually broke Anthrax.
Oh, really?
That was one of the big successful tours that really made them move up. Mm. With all the publicity on Headbanger Ball and all the music and all the videos and the interviews. It was like, you'd think the Anthrax owned Headbanger Ball for a while. And in that time, it exploded. Anthrax I was struggling with for a while. You know, it wasn't like Metallica. It really took off, so during and after the Headbanger Ball tour. And then they did me the favor again, but the video stood on its own 2 feet for Bring the Noise, which was an MTV, like, number 2 video.
Whose idea was it to pair Public Enemy and Anthrax?
Well, it sort of was destined to happen, because Anthrax are mentioned in the Public Enemy song Bring the Noise, and Anthrax, especially Scott Ian, is always wearing, and Charlie wearing, Public Enemy shirts. And they did the I'm the Man. And the next logical choice was Bring the Noise. We took Public Enemy, we being Anthrax. It just happened with phone calls. It just happened. Because from Bring the Noise came the Anthrax Public Enemy tour.
Right.
Which was done on the bus when we were shooting the Bring the Noise video. When we said to Chuck, you know, we should take this everywhere, man. It'll be amazing. He said, I'm down with that. I like that. He said. So we did that, and we went out on that sellout tour. It was tremendous. In fact, we had Primus open. It was Primus, Public Enemy, Anthrax.
Wow. A question from a listener. Did you think that Speak English or Die would be so significant a record?
We really liked it a lot. You know, Speak English or Die was something that Marcia Zazula really championed, even more than me. Because I was like saying, what are people going to say when they hear songs like F the Middle East and all that stuff? I mean, the album's way ahead of its time almost, you know?
Right.
I just loved it for its intensity and its brilliance and its genius. as much as I loved it, Marsha, you know, loved it more. You know, what was funny with FOD was that they did that Freddy Krueger song.
Yes.
So we called up Robert Englund's agent, and Robert Englund went and did the photo shoot as Freddy Krueger with SOD.
Nice.
We shot it in the studio, and then we shot SOD in the front of CBGB's, and, you know, it was a really good shoot. We had a good shooter. We sent out about 5 slides, and what happened was for cover features or features, period, and we ended up with like 12 covers.
Wow.
Yeah, it
surprise,
was like
surprise.
Really crazy. In fact, in Germany, someone was so excited that they made note of it in one of their articles. They called me Herr Music Director, H-E-R-R Music Director in Germany, because I pulled that off. I didn't even know it was going to happen. Just everybody loved the shoot so much. It was on the cover of every hard rock magazine, every metal magazine.
Yeah, I definitely remember those photos.
Yeah, they were great. And SOD, what can I say about SOD, man? They were great.
And that concludes another podcast episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. More on the way. I am Diane Kamikaze. Check my Twitter and my Instagram. Handle is one word, Diane Kamikaze. Kamikaze ends with an E. On Facebook, you can find me as Diane Kamikaze Farris, Rocker for Life and Making a Difference. The full link to my index of shows and podcasts can be found on wfmu.org/playlists/DK. That's a capital D and a capital K. I'm going to be working on encore presentations, and I've got years of interviews and podcasts. So if there's something that you'd like to see reposted that you missed, please get in touch. Send me email, diane@wfmu.org. And be sure to subscribe to the show. And if you like it, please rate it and review it. Wow. WFMU. Peer pressure. Thank you. See you next time.